Hi, I'm Kay, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I'm thrilled to be here. I'm so moved already. This is a bad sign to be this emotional in the first few minutes, but what Julie was referring to is, you know, the custom at conventions is you have someone who's your hostess and they meet you at the airport. And it was really my fault because she had called me a few days ago and I was supposed to call her back and I just got crazy at work and I didn't call her back. So I thought, oh, well, she'll be there. But I really didn't know where the convention was. I didn't know what hotel I was staying at. You know, I just sort of shoot from the hip. I'm a little impulsive. But anyway, so I get off the aircraft today about 3:30 and I walk out and I'm looking for someone and I don't see anyone. Of course, she had told me months ago, I'll see you at baggage claim, but I didn't remember that. So I get off the plane and I'm looking for her and I'm going up to strangers and saying, are you an AA? Are you Julie? And there was not a sober member at Atlanta's airport today, I'm telling you. Not one. So then we realized that we had crossed each other's path at some point. So it occurs to me, well, you know, it's probably downtown Atlanta. And so I catch a cab. Now, this is like 30 minutes later. I think, well, you know, never occurs to me to make some phone calls. So I get in the cab, and he says, where do you want to go? And I said, the Hyatt. So because my company stays at the Hyatt downtown. So I went to the Hyatt, and I get out, and the guy was really, really sweet. And I went inside, and I called a few people, and I just really didn't know where the convention was. And then I called Central Office, of course. And the guy knew immediately where it was, and he directed me here. So I sort of got here eventually. But that's just like me not to ask questions, you know what I mean? Not to start my journey blindly, you know, and sort of the story of my life. When I was flying here today, and I'm sure this is for all of us who had to fly, it's been a little scary lately in the air, you know, and particularly with what just happened in Los Angeles. And I got on board the aircraft, and I'm sort of in the industry. I do that sort of thing. I deal with corporate travel, so I travel a lot. But I hadn't traveled recently in about a couple of months. So I get on the airplane. There's a couple of guys sitting behind me, and they're very loud and very chatty, and they're describing what can happen with an airplane and how any of these things can go down just like that, you know. And I'm trying not to listen, and but they're so loud, and I'm trying to stay centered, and I start to pray because I really don't want to get that going, you know how that is. And then I thought, oh good, the Meryl Streep movie Music of the Heart was the movie on the airplane. So I thought, great, I love Meryl Streep, I'll watch the movie, drown these jerks out behind me. And it was one of those wonderful emotional movies, you know, that just, I was the only one really watching the film, I could tell. But it was so touching, and there's a wonderful line in the movie that reminded me of AA. She's talking to a woman who has difficulty physically, and she says, you know, you've got to, the little girl says, well, I can't play the violin because I can't stand up straight and strong. And she said, you've got to learn inside to stand up straight and strong. And I realized that that's what I have. It's a bad sign. From Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so honored to be with you tonight. I cannot tell you. And here we are, women together. And what is our common denominator besides being women is that we're alcoholics who are sober and living this life. And it is a miracle. And I've grown up here. This summer, in August, I'll be sober 25 years. And I know. And as you know, we have a lot of help along the way all the time. I see coming here this weekend as a refuge. It has been sheer hell back at home. Just everything has been going on. I'm not a big fan of change, and there's been nothing but that. I worked for a company who, I worked for the CEO, and she just resigned, and it made all the newspapers. It did locally. I don't know if it did here, but basically all of us are in a very vulnerable position. And then I got a little panicky, and I went to the Dodgers and interviewed with the Dodgers, and the interview was going fine, and But just towards the end of it, I blurted out, by the way, I'm in AA. You've got to pick your spots. You've got to pick your spots in your audience. And he just sort of looked at me and said, thank you so much for coming. And he sort of shook my hand, and I knew I was finished with the Dodgers. But it's just, like I said, there's just been a lot going on. But it's not life and death. I have learned here that life and death is life and death, and everything else isn't. It is just stuff, and it's just stuff to deal with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in keeping with the format that is customary, what it used to be like, what happened, and what we hope it's like today, I grew up right by LAX into a very WASPy family. Is this echoing only to me? It's echoing everywhere? Am I standing too close? Okay. You can hear, though? Okay. Where was I? Oh, yes. So, anyway, I was born into this very WASPy family, and I had two brothers, and my mother decided to leave my father when I was about four. She sort of kicked him out of the house because she said he was an alcoholic. And I loved my dad. I was my father's daughter. My dad was a 50s playboy kind of guy, very cute. He used to slick his hair back, and he had one of those old bachelor pads, you know, with a backlit scene of Hawaii behind the bar. Playboy posters everywhere, and he loved big-breasted manicurists, basically. So Monday night was visitation night, and my dad would pick me up on Mondays in his 54 Chevy, and I would stand next to him in the car with my arm around his neck. I loved my dad, and he was always tan, and he always had a cigarette in his hand and a glass of bourbon. And I just loved the whole look and feel and smell. And he would say, all right, now, honey, we're going to just make a little pit stop before I take you home. We're just going to stop off at the Melody Room right by the airport, and your dad's going to have a couple of drinks. And that was fine with me because I loved the bar scene. I was four, maybe 5 years old, but I could already tell it was the happiest place on earth. I was impressed with the lighting at an early age. I liked the dim lights and the dark atmosphere and the red carpeting and the red leather booths, and everybody seemed to be very jovial. I only found out later that they weren't really talking to each other. They were talking past each other because they were all loaded. But I used to love going with my dad to the bar, and we'd sit there for hours, and I'd nurse my Shirley Temple, and he'd have his bourbons, and he'd get drunk, and he'd take me home, and my mother would be furious. And this would go on every week. I would go out with my dad, and like I said, I was crazy about my dad because my dad was crazy about me. You know, I was pretty easy. I'm still that way. If you like me, I like you back. If you don't, you know, well. But I'm pretty whorish in that capacity. But he did. He just liked me a lot. And I suppose, like most of us, I was insecure from the gate and in need of approval every few minutes. And he gave it to me, so I was crazy about him. Well, my mother remarried, and she remarried this fellow who I wasn't as thrilled with as my father because he was very, very strict, and I was very, very belligerent. I was a very frightened kid, phobic from the beginning, afraid of everything, dogs. I was afraid of dogs, which is very inconvenient. It's one thing if you're afraid of snakes or bears or something that you're not going to really come in contact with, but everybody had a dog. So I was always in angst. Walking to elementary school was hideous because these neighbors of ours had this chihuahua, and they're the worst, aren't they? They're the worst. I'm pissed off that they've come back into popularity with this Taco Bell stuff, because there was this chihuahua that lived down the street, and this dog would yip and bark, and you know, you're always told, don't run. Look at that dog and be strong and show it who's boss and don't run. And I would try to be strong and I would try to have courage, but I would run. And that little yipper would follow me down the street. And I'd be crying by the time I got there. And so being that I was so fearful all the time, I masked it with belligerent behavior. Inside, I was very, very scared, but outside, I was, I don't care. And that was my demeanor. I don't care, and this family is lame, and I don't want to have anything to do with you. And my big word was no. Everything with me was contempt prior to investigation. Down to, let's go to Disneyland, I don't want to. I never wanted to do anything. Well, my stepfather didn't like this, and they wanted me to get in line. So they would punish me a lot, but they had strange chores, like picking up lint off the backyard lawn, which I never understood. Still don't, but I would be smart-ass, you know, back to them. And so they had this punishment that they developed called the white chair. And the white chair was just that. It was a little white chair in the corner of my room, and I would have to sit there, I'm assuming, and change my behavior or my attitude. Well, I lived on that white chair. And it got to the point, I was there so much that I thought, well, you know, you better learn how to entertain yourself because, you know, this is where you're going to be living for your childhood. And I developed the art of fantasizing. And I was good at it. And I was able to fantasize them away, and I fantasized an entire new family who I called the Howard family. And I was everybody in this family, the men, the women, everybody. And it got to the point that I would go to the white chair for recreational purposes, you know. And I'd get all riled up, you know. I'd start playing my adventure, and I would sort of tap my hands and to fantasize, and my hair would be all over the place, and I'd be kind of sweaty and wild-eyed, and I'd come out, and my family absolutely didn't know what to do with me. And I was that way at school even. I had a choir teacher say to me, because you always look like you're in trouble, like you're up to something. And I guess I did. I don't know. Because like I said, inside I was just frightened and just wanted to fit in and just wanted to feel okay within my skin, you know. But I just didn't know how to go about it, like so many of us. But one summer, between the ages of about 12 and 13, all hell broke loose. I had had yet another punishment, and this one was a little more severe than others. I had done something. I'd lied about something, and they got real upset about it. And so they put me on what they called privilege restriction. And what that meant was, is that I couldn't talk in the house. I had to write on a tablet. I had to go to bed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I couldn't watch television or use the phone. And again, their methodology was to get me to, like I said, to change my attitude and go with the flow. But I just, instead of that working to the positive, I got worse. And I just thought, to hell with it, to hell with all of you. And I was a little Girl Scout at the time, and I had a little ponytail and wore little bobby socks and was sort of an athletic kind of kid and basically a straight-A student. I was a good kid, except for that belligerent problem. But that summer, I don't know, I just thought, that does it. And I cut off the ponytail, and I started ratting my hair up real high, and I ripped off my Girl Scout uniform and started wearing short, red, tight skirts. And this was in the 60s, and in those days, girls kind of had three choices. You could be a surfer chick, you could be a cheerleader, or you could be a lowrider. And I became the lowrider. And like I said, I ratted my hair up real high, and I'll tell you, when I came back to school that summer, people were alarmed at the change that had taken place. I was still the same person, but I didn't look like the same person. And I therefore attracted an entire new group of friends. And they were the drug addicts of Westchester High. And I looked like one of them, and so they took me into their group. And I started dating this guy, and he was the biggest drug dealer at the school. And he had a 1949 Oldsmobile that was lowered with a gold metal flake top. How many people remember lowered cars? And many people, thank you. And he had the hydraulic lifts where the car goes up and down. And I'd kind of push my hair down to get into the vehicle. And we'd smoke dope, and we'd listen to the Chambers Brothers and the Doors and the Seeds and whoever else we used to listen to and get very loaded and drive up and down Manchester Boulevard and go home and maybe analyze an album cover for weeks, you know, weeks and weeks. And so I was introduced to the dope smoking set, and you know, it sort of saved my life, because the dope smoking set, you know, they welcome you in too. And again, you can be in a world of your own, because everybody else is too, you know. So it was terrific for me. But I didn't drink. And I didn't drink because I had tried my dad's bourbon at one point and I hated it. And so I thought, well, I just won't drink. But I was yet to discover the wonderful world of alcohol. At this time, I was working in a theater, and I was a usherette, as we used to call it. And this one night, I was very tired, kind of sleepy. Funny Girl, the movie Funny Girl had just opened, and it was a big deal in Los Angeles. And we had thousands of people. We had to get in and out and in a hurry for intermission. And I said to one of my friends, I said, you know, I'm fatigued, Bob. And so he said, well, you're tired. He said, well, take one of these. And, you know, we take something, we ask later what it is, or we never ask at all. And I took it, and it was a little white pill. I took it, and about 5 minutes later, I went back to Bob, and I said, you know, I'm still kind of tired, Bob. I don't think it did anything. He said, well, take another. So I took another. Now, I'm impatient. I took another. In a course of about 10 minutes, I had basically taken 10 mini whites. And I was wired. I got those people back in their seats with their popcorn and hands folded before that curtain ever went back up. I then proceeded to go home and for 3 days scribble on a tablet, again with my hair sticking straight out to here, vomiting nothing. And yet I never got in trouble. My mother came in my room and she said, honey, what's wrong with you? And I said, I have the flu, and she never pursued it. She never went on to ask me why I was vomiting and having the hair stick straight out and sweating profusely and scribbling for 3 days solid. Never came up. So then I added to my repertoire speed. So now I had dope, speed. And then I was introduced to the world of downers a couple years after that. But I was not a downer kind of girl, because they knocked me out. They put me to sleep. And I could never stay up on them to really enjoy the high. But when I got to, and I have to tell you too, that during this time that I'm doing this, there still is a part of me that wanted to be a part of you, that wanted to be a part of the world. Again, I just didn't know how, and I had bad grooming habits. I had this philosophy that walking towards a person was sort of all that mattered, and that once you walked, you were gone, it didn't matter about the backside. So I never brushed the back of my hair. And if I had a spot on my blouse, I'd twist it to the back to hide it. Or if I had a run in my stocking, it went from the front to the back. So again, walking towards you, I looked semi-together, but the back of me was a mess. Now, you can't rat your hair like that with a can of hairspray and not comb out the back on occasion. So there's a price to pay. And the price to pay was I had this knot of hair like this, like you see on Skid Row when people come in and they've got this matted hair. I had that at 16 on the back of my head. And I have to tell you that I was mortified. I mean, I didn't want to be different, even though I had this thing. And I remember sitting in high school assemblies hoping that people wouldn't see this and hearing, you know, people behind me say, what is it? You know, on the back of her head. And the curious part to me now is all I had to do, the angst that this caused me to be so different with this thing, all I had to do was go to a hairdresser. He would have taken 3 seconds and cut it out. It would have been over. But it never occurred to me. I just thought that was part of life. Life is just uncomfortable. It just is uncomfortable. So I lived with this thing for about 3 years, and I'm not exaggerating, for about 3 years. And again, I just thought that's how it is. Meanwhile, my family is really getting tired of my action, because I've got these three brothers now. I got a stepbrother added in there. And they're valedictorian, and one's captain of the football team. They're gorgeous. I look back now at family photographs, and they're all these big white teeth and they're looking straight into the camera, making eye contact, and I'm off somewhere, you know. And here's their hooker sister, you know. A friend of mine recently had heard my story, and she didn't believe me, and she recently saw some home movie, and she goes, oh, my God, you really were. Yeah. Just trampy looking, you know. But again, I never drank because I just didn't like it. But when I was about 18, I met this one guy, and he point blank told me, I want you to impress my friends tonight at this party. And I said, you know, Alan, I don't do that. I said, that's not something I do. I just want to get loaded and kind of sit in the corner. He said, no, I need you to be a hostess. I need you to impress them. And I said, well, I don't know how I'm going to do this. He said, well, get drunk, for Christ's sake. He said, loosen up. He said, you speed people. You're so uptight. So I said, well, I don't like it. I just don't like it. And he asked one of his friends to come over. He said, get her something. So he said, oh, I got it. So he brought me a bottle of this stuff called Right Time. Right Time was a carbonated malt liquor wine. They do not make it anymore. But it was very sickeningly sweet, sort of like cold duck used to be. Remember cold duck? And I loved all that stuff. The sweeter, the syrup, I loved it. Well, I cracked open this cap, and I held my nose, and I gagged down the bottle. And then I gagged down the second bottle. Third, fourth, fifth, whatever it was, I got drunk immediately, and I was the hostess that he wanted me to be. I felt pretty. I felt Hepburn-ish. I was able to do whatever he wanted me to do. And I basically thought, when I went home that night, why would you ever stop doing this? This is the greatest thing God's ever invented for people like me who can't be comfortable for a moment to drink this magic liquid. It's legal. You don't have to worry about narcotics officers following you in a vehicle. You know, you don't go to jail for what you do now. And maybe you did then, I don't know. But I mean, it's legal, and it was cheap. You know, none of this $50 stuff. I mean, this, for $1.89, I could go to the local liquor store and get a half gallon of Gallo Rheingarten wine. And so that was my first love, was Gallo Rheingarten wine. And I loved it. And I drank alcoholically from that night until I got here. I never had a sober day after that. I just never did. And again, why bother? So I became the drinker. And I told my friends, I announced it, that I was going to be a drinker now. And my roommates couldn't believe it, because I was always on the floor, passed out when they brought their boyfriends home. And I got weird quick. I got weird really, really quick. I moved into an apartment in Santa Monica, and it was a 3-bedroom apartment. Now, it was just me, and it had a formal dining room. I was not having dinner parties, but I had this apartment. Again, it looked good on the outside, but I had no furniture on the inside. I had a mattress on the floor of one of the rooms. I had a refrigerator, but the only thing I had in it was my Gallo wine and a leftover can of cat food that, you know, if I had the extra money, my cat would get it, you know. If I didn't, she wouldn't. It was just that simple. And if people came over to visit me, I'd have to open the door just a crack so they couldn't see inside my house. I always had a job for some strange reason. You know, we're really good at interviews until this last week. Blew that one. But I used to be really good at interviews, and until I got hired. And then once I got hired, I was lazy. I think that alcoholics, this is my own little opinion, but I think we have the ability to put on the right face at the right time when push comes to shove. You know, we can do it. So I would get these jobs, and then, you know, I'd find myself drunk at lunch one day, and we'd have these styrofoam kind of ceilings, and I'd take my pencil and throw them up to see if they'd stick. And then I'd ask if anybody in the office wanted Twinkies from the local liquor store, because I was volunteering to go get them. And I'd go get them and get myself another bottle of wine. At one point, I was working at a hotel. I got into the hotel business, and I was a desk clerk. And this was like 1970 or something. And We used to wear these really short, tight blue dresses and white boots that came just below the knee. We thought we were cute. And the girl that worked at the desk with me was a drinker like I was, and we had a good time. And we'd have the guys from the bar bring us over our Kahlua and schnapps and Harvey's Bristol Cream. Ooh, all that stuff, you know. And we'd have it under the, and we'd check people in, and we'd take a drink, and we'd just be drunk, just drunk. And I'd get off work, but by the time I got off work, it was about 11 o'clock at night, and I am so drunk that if what I used to do is I would look to see if there was an empty hotel room in the hotel, take the key, go let myself in, go to sleep, well, pass out on the floor until I knew that the maid was coming. I'd arrange a wake-up call, then try to get out, and then slip out the back fire escape. And remember those hangovers, you know, where it was so bright and sunny outside, and, you know, your false eyelash was over here, and, you know, and I'm going down the fire escape to go home, and just, oh, God, it was bright outside, you know. And if I had decided to drive home that night, you know, the way you have to kind of do this. And I used to have at that time a Dodge Challenger. Now, a Dodge Challenger, it had a 440 Magnum engine in this car. It idled at 55, you know. And I'm driving in this thing drunk. And, you know, recently there was that woman on the news. I don't know if you heard about this. I was just so floored when I heard this. You know, she was like a third-time offender. It just happened. And she killed people being drunk. And they put her away, I think it's for 60 years, right? 60 years she's in prison. And you just know she's an alcoholic. And a lot of people were calling in to this talk show. And they were saying, boy, throw her away. And I know it was a third offense. And I know, you know, she did kill people. But I couldn't help but want them to have some leniency. You know what I mean? I guess because I felt like her. Thank God I didn't kill anybody. But it was not because of me. It was because of God. Left up to me, I could have wiped out neighborhoods the way that I drove and as drunk as I drove. What began to happen in my life around this point is I began to lose all sense of my nervous system. And I began to have anxiety attacks wherever I went. My life got this small, and I learned how to live in it. Things that I could do, I would slowly write them off the list as things, well, I used to do them, but I guess they're not that important. Like go to the grocery market, get my clothes from the cleaners, go to restaurants and sit with people while we're eating dinner. There were things I could no longer do because I was flipping out right and left. I had gone to a therapist, and I would call her from restaurants or wherever I was or from the office, just flipping out in absolute panic. And I'd say, Dorothy, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And she'd say, honey, just hang in there, just hang in there. And I kept going to her, and I have to tell you, I went to her for about 2 years. She never asked me. And I smelled like wine. I had to. I was drunk all the time. But she never asked me how much I drank. It just didn't come up in conversation. I didn't volunteer. She didn't ask. But I would go to her for a couple of years, and we learned a lot. You know, we learned that I was insecure, felt less than, didn't feel a part of. You know, we had it all written out. I knew exactly what the problem was. And I remember one day saying to her, Dorothy, I know all this, but what do I do about it? And I started to cry, and she said, honey, I don't know. I'm not a mechanic. I'll see you next week. Now, I have to tell you, this woman, this was 25 years ago, and I think people, particularly in the therapy industry, have learned a lot more than they used to know. They know to ask now. They know about us. But they were still learning, I think, in those days. I really do. And so she couldn't help me. But so I had my little routine, and that was how I was going to learn to live for the rest of my life. And my routine consisted of this, and this is pretty much how it was every day for the last year of my drinking. I finally found a roommate who would let me for $75 sleep on her couch. She had a three-year-old son and a little boy, a little three-year-old, why I said that, and a woman who lived in who helped her with a three-year-old son. And I knew every morning when I got up that Margaret would take her little boy to preschool, and I had about 15 minutes. And in that 15 minutes, between the time she took him and the time she came back, I would go to the refrigerator and scrape off the frost of the freezer so I could just take off the room temperature off my jug that I had saved from the night before for morning, got to have your stash, just to take off that room temperature warmth so I could belt down a few drinks until she got back. She was also a nurse, and I knew where she kept the Valiums, and so I would steal her Valiums on a regular basis. Then I would go to work, and then I would come home, and I had this album that I would listen to every night. This was my routine, and I'd put the album on. It was Joni Mitchell's Court and Spark. Fabulous album, still is. I would put this album on, and I'd listen to this album, and I'd sort of rock and hum on the end of my bed and sort of look in the mirror and wonder what happened, you know, back and forth. And then I think, okay, it's time to go out for dinner. So I would get all dolled up, you know, I'd put on tons of makeup, get all dressed up, get in my Dodge Challenger with my 440 Magnum engine, and I'd drive to the restaurant that I dined in every evening, which was the Jack in the Box on Manchester Avenue. And I'd get to the Jack Head, and it took every amount of courage that I had to order what I ordered every day, which was a breakfast Jack and a cup of black coffee. And I know you know what I mean when I say it took every bit of courage that I had. And if I'd muster to get this out, and then I'd drive up to the window, and I'd sort of hope that she wouldn't see inside my car, because I had the alcoholic's car, you know, with the breakfast Jack wrappers from 2 years previous, the wine bottles, the cigarette wrappers, the ashes, just, you know, sort of like I would move the trash aside as I put myself in my vehicle. And again, just hoping she wouldn't see inside my car, like people hoping they wouldn't see like the thing on the back of my head, you know. Hopefully I was invisible, so to speak. And then I'd go home and I think, great, mission accomplished. This was a good day. And that's my life. That was the extent of my accomplishment. You know, that was what I did. I'd get drunk, I'd go to Jack in the Box, I'd go home. I'd scrape the ice, I'd get drunk, I'd go to the Jack in the Box, I'd come home, I'd scrape the ice. And one day, October of 1974, I was walking on the bed listening to Joni Mitchell, and there's a song on that album, and I never remember this, I really don't, but I'm going to try, where she says, you need love in the, you can't give love in this condition, still you know how you need it. And I was beginning to, and I listened to this album every day, but it was sort of like listening to the lyrics. And, you know, I don't know how much was seeping in. All I know is I was listening to the song, and I started getting kind of emotional. And I just said, God help me. God help me. And that night, I was supposed to be starting junior college. And I used to start junior college a lot. Again, I'm real good at the beginning, but I don't follow through, you know, but I'll show up for the beginning. So anyway, I got in my Dodge Challenger, and I drove to Santa Monica Junior College, and I had my jug of Gallo between my knees as I was driving, and I'm, you know, crying, basically. And I pull into my parking spot, and at the same time I pull into my parking spot, this blue van pulls in next to me. And I get out of my car, and this young girl gets out of her car, and we find ourselves sort of walking through the campus side by side. We kind of look at each other, and she said, you look like you're lost. And I said, I am. I don't know where this classroom is. And she said, well, what are you taking? And I said, business management or whatever it was. And she said, oh. I said, what are you taking? Well, she said, well, I'm not taking a class. She said, actually, I'm here tonight to give a lecture on alcoholism and drug abuse. I said, for it or against it? I had no idea why you would talk about such a thing. You know, this was in the days when you just didn't... I mean, there were your movies, you know, the Susan Hayward movie. I mean, you saw movies about alcoholism, but I don't know. I just thought it was peculiar that she was going to give this talk. And, of course, what I really thought was peculiar is that this is the person that I'm walking next to in the school, and she takes an interest in me, so to speak, and she says, well, look, here's your classroom. Why don't you give me your phone number? And I said, oh, okay. And I thought she might be interested in me. You know, I mean, I didn't know. You know, I wasn't particularly attractive. You know, I had sort of matted hair and yellow complexion and makeup on top of last week's makeup, if you know what I mean. And it was summer, and I was always dressed for the wrong occasion. This was during the 70s where, you know, we wore the really, really tight jeans and the platform shoes and scarves around your neck and like Saturday Night Fever kind of attire. And it was... We were having a heat wave in Los Angeles, but I'm dressed in a wool jacket, a turtleneck sweater, and a scarf. And Maybe she knew that I had a problem. You know, I don't know. But I gave her my phone number. And I have to tell you, this was God in my life doing for me what I could not do for myself. Because as I told you, the story of my life is no. Do you want to do this? No. Do you want to try? No. Do you want to give that a shot? No. Mm-mm. Everything with me was no, because everything scared me. Change scared me. My parents would have to ease me into the fact that they would be redoing the living room, you know, because I just wanted things in their place. I now look back and realize that it was just fear of the unknown. I was just so terrified. And obviously I had nothing that I trusted, nothing to believe in. Stuff was there, let's face it. Other people have things, but I was, this disease just separates you from the world. And it is a disease of loneliness. And But I gave her my phone number. And then I went home, and I didn't think too too much about it. But the next morning, I was sitting on the front lawn with my roommate's three-year-old son, and we were in heavy debate over something, and he was winning the argument. And he intimidated me, this fellow. I swear to God, he intimidated me, this three-year-old. And I was drinking my cheap champagne at this point, and the gas man had driven by, and he kind of looked at me with sort of that bum look that we get. And the phone rang, and it was this girl that I met at Santa Monica Junior College. And she said, are you sober right now? I said, no. And she said, well, are you sober enough to drive to the Marriott Hotel at LAX and meet me? And I said, oh, okay. And again, I don't say okay to anything. But I got in my car and I went. And I met this girl, and we were sitting in the cocktail lounge of the Marriott Hotel, and she started to ask me questions, and I started to answer her. And I said, it's so interesting, it's so weird, June, that you are in this AA, because I'm thinking of going on the wagon. And she burst into hysteric laughter. And I said, what's so funny? And she said, well, to people in AA, going on the wagon doesn't mean a whole lot. They usually fall right back off. So we started to talk about this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, but you know what, June? I said, I know that I have a problem. I know that, but I'm young. I mean, I'm 22 years old. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. And she kind of mumbled her age to me, and I didn't hear her. I thought she said she was 50. I said, you look great for 50. She goes, no. She goes, I'm 15. I was very out of touch. She was 15 years old, and she had 2 years of sobriety. And I know a lot of you know who she is. It's June G, and I'm sure she spoke here. She speaks everywhere. And she's who 12-stepped me onto this program. And she's who took me under her wing. And at that moment, what I didn't realize is from living a life in essence like a wild animal, my life had just changed, and I didn't even know it. And it only changed because I said yes to this girl in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, all right, come with me. We're going to go to a meeting. I said, I can't do that. And she said, what do you mean you can't do that? I said, well, I have anxiety. I flip out. I can't be in rooms. I can't be in lightly lit rooms. I can't do it. She said, well, honey, you're going to have to. And she said, we'll help you. Now, I thought when she said, we'll help you, that meant we'll give you a sedative. But that's not what she meant. We went to this meeting, and you know, I don't know what it is about Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, particularly where I come from, but the lighting is always that dermatologist lighting. It is so bright. I hadn't been in bright lighting in about 5 years, nor had I wanted to be. We walk into this brightly lit room. There's probably 400 people, big meeting, and she sits me down in the front, and I start to flip out because that's what I do, and so she grabbed one of my wrists, and her friend Bob grabbed the other. And I didn't hear a lot of what was said, but there was a woman who was speaking that night, this big, blonde woman from Texas. And she talked about that she no longer had panic attacks. And she got my attention, and I heard that. And that's all I needed to hear, and that's what I heard. And it was my hook. And I thought, oh, God, if I could just be cured. I don't know if I thought about quitting drinking yet, but I thought if I could only be cured of panic attacks. And darn it, this woman had been cured of panic attacks. So I thanked June at the end of the evening. I said, I'll see you in a week. And she said, no, we're now going to go to a candlelight meeting. And she took me to a candlelight meeting. And basically, June moved me in, and it was a good thing. She had a little crappy little place, little dumpy apartment on Overland Avenue in Los Angeles, just a hole, this apartment. It was worse than some of the places I was in drinking, you know? But it's where I got sober, because she didn't have a lot of... She was 15, you know? She did not have a huge payroll, income at the time. And we had this little... And I slept on the couch, and then finally the couch had a fold-out bed, and so we sort of slept together there. And she fed me this program, and she took me to meetings, and I got to hear some of the greatest speakers of all time, like Chuck C. You know, a lot of you know who Chuck C was. I had about 2 weeks of sobriety, and we go to the San Diego, Southern California roundup. 7,000 alcoholics, easy, 7,000 alcoholics. Huge convention room, and I'm sitting there, and Chuck is standing at the podium, and he had this sort of spotlight on him, and he had this white hair, you know, and it sort of made him look like a Catholic saint. Not that I'm Catholic, but it gave him this sort of spiritual look to him, and she kept saying, that's one of the most spiritual men in AA. And he was sort of a legend, remember? I don't know, some of you might remember. He had thousands of years of sobriety then, you know. And he came up to me at the break, and he said, your name is Kay, and you're new. I thought, oh my God, he is so spiritual. Now, June had told him, go say hi to the newcomer Kay, Chuck, and he did. But I'll tell you, I was so enamored with AA. I loved AA. I did. I was crazy about it. I thought, this is so great. And I had anxiety attacks really for the first 3 years, to tell you the truth. I had a hard time as a newcomer. I used to sleep in the fetal position in the living room on my floor for about the first year. And I would have to sleep in the clothes that I had on at work, because that was just where my fear level left me off at here. But anyway, so June and I would be sleeping in the same bed, and she'd take me to meetings, and I was like her sidekick. Well, one day, June got a little upset at me because I was also, at that time, realizing my sexual preference. I had really known when I was a kid, but I thought, well, you know, if you don't act on it, it doesn't mean that you are, you know? But I knew I was gay, basically. So I would introduce myself and say, hi, I'm Kay, I'm new, and I think I might be gay. To everyone. And absolutely everyone. You know how when we're new, we just think that our drama is of such interest to everyone else. And finally, June had just broken up with this guy. So the last thing she wanted was to have this reputation that I was going to be giving her, you know. So she thought, oh my God, you know. So she went to Chuck C. And she said, Chuck, what do I do about this newcomer? I mean, she's just telling the world that she's gay, and they're going to think I am. And he said, send her to her own people. And she did. She loaded me up in her Volkswagen, and she sent me to this group of gay girls out in the valley and dropped me off, basically. It sounds horrible. She did it in a very loving way, you know, but she dropped me off with these girls, and I walked in, and this girl named Mary R. was standing there. She said, what do you want? And I told her, and she said, come on in. And that was just sort of the beginning of my sobriety. And basically, it's not to distance myself from you, but it's just to be honest as to who I am, because I find that that's what we get here in Alcoholics Anonymous, too, is the freedom to be who we are. And what a freedom that is, isn't it? Whoa. I know. Yeah. Anyway. But I have to tell you, I was still in my first year, and I had a problem. One of my problems was that I loved the program, but I really didn't want to work it. You know what I mean? I wanted to be sober, but I thought, if I just go to meetings, won't that be enough? And I wore the Serenity Prayer necklace. I swear you could see it from the back of the room, these massive praying hands. And I would 12-step my aunts and uncles and people who absolutely did not want to be sober. But I just didn't want to work the program. And so I did the sponsor shuffle, you know, where I'd get a sponsor, and then 2 months later I'd have like a joint and have to change my sobriety and raise my hand as a newcomer again. And I got into my own drama. I could see the credits rolling past. You know, she's back. That I was around her, I would slip like every 2 months on something. It would be a drink, or it would be a joint, or it would be a codeine pill, or something that we're not supposed to do. And I would do that, and I would come back, and I'd get a new sponsor. Well, this one day, and this was in August of 1975, which is my sobriety month, I was at this pool party in the valley, and there was this gay woman out there who was meaner than hell, a real fascist on this program. She was so mean, I could not stand her. And she didn't like me either. We really could not stand each other. It was exactly what I needed. And she said, "Kay, did you slip again?" And I said, "Yeah." And I kind of was smirking, you know, like, "Yeah." And she said, "All right, that does it. Everybody leave. I want to talk to her alone." I should have known I was in trouble right then. Everybody had to leave the pool area. And she sat and she said, "Kay, how do you feel when you're out there doing it? She goes, I've heard you tell your story. You don't sound like you were a happy person. How did you feel when you were out there?" So I thought, oh my, what am I going to say to shut her up and get her off my back? You know, so I said, "Well, Jerry, I didn't feel a part of. I felt less than. You know, I thought of every one-liner I could think of just to get her off my back." And she said, "Were you lonely?" And the moment she said, "Were you lonely?" I started to cry. And I mean, I started to sob. And I said, "Yeah, I'm lonely." And she said, "This is a life and death situation, and you got to get it. And for people like you die. People like you are not success stories in life. You're disgusting alcoholics that end up in gutters. Is that what you want? Do you think that's cute? Is that something you'd like to smirk about now?" And that's how tough she was. And but I heard her. You've heard the expression, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. I was ready. In spite of my smart-ass me, I was ready. And she said, "But we're going to do it my way." And I said, "Okay." And like I said, we couldn't stand each other. And I was always envious because I knew she liked her other babies better. And trust me, it wasn't my imagination. She did. She told me that later on. So I was right. But again, I even knew, you know how I think that there's a part of us, there's a God part of us, even at our worst, if we don't kill it, and we can kill it, that kind of knew, go with her. Go with her. Do what she's telling you to do. And that was really the beginning of my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a program of action, and it was to take actions that seemed absolutely absurd. And I would call her up, and maybe somebody would break my heart. And I'd say, "Jerry, so-and-so doesn't care about me." And she'd say, "I don't give a damn." She goes, "You just go to that meeting, you stand at that door, and you shake hands." And I'd think, "Did you hear me?" And she'd say, "You just get out of yourself." And I remember thinking, how in the world is this going to help me? But I would do it. And I remember the very first night that I had a little smidgen of self-worth. It was a Thanksgiving night, and I had collected a lot of parking tickets when I was drinking, and I would just throw them away, you know, take them off the car and throw them away. And in those days, you'd have to pay for them or they'd take you to jail. And I had left my parents' house, and I was driving to a potluck at this clubhouse that we have, and I got stopped by the police for a taillight, and they ran a make, and they found out that I had like $500 worth of $15 parking tickets. And sure enough, they took me to jail. But they just took me to, like, the holding center. They didn't take me inside. So I kind of started flirting with the cops, and it worked, you know. We're good at that. Come on, aren't we? I think we are. We are. So I started, you know, if we have to. So I started flirting with the cops, and they brought me a piece of lemon meringue pie, and we had coffee, and they said, "Look, go ahead and make a few phone calls," which they do let you do, you know. So I called the clubhouse. And my friends were all there getting ready for the meeting, and they said, "Okay, how much do we need?" And they all pulled their money together, you know, which was quite a bit, and they bailed me out of jail. They stopped me from going to jail, let's say, Sybil Brand. And I was wearing this T-shirt that said, "Hot." We were, you know, this was the 70s. We were very obnoxious. It was just sort of the fashion issue of the day. But I went to the meeting, and I was standing in the back, and I was so grateful that my friends, my newfound friends, bailed me out of the slammer. And I was standing in the back, and it was Thanksgiving, so we had the potluck, and I started serving people. And there was this newcomer who was coming through the line, and I remember caring more about her than my recent drama of almost having to go to jail. And I thought, oh my God. And I was shocked. I was alarmed that for once in my life, I actually was caring for somebody else. And it was the beginning. It was the beginning of undoing the selfishness that this disease brings with. And I began to live a sober life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a true program of action. I was very fortunate. When I had about 4 years of sobriety, I met someone that I really, really fell in love with. And we had this beautiful home up in the hills, and we had money and all, we had it all. We had this beautiful home, and I usually right around here, I like to say cheer up, it all went away, because I've actually had moments where, see, at the time, I thought that this was a result of working a good program. Was wealth and love and power and prestige and all that stuff. And I'll tell you, it was great for a long time, for like 13 years. Now, mind you, I still was working a program during this time, and a very, you know, I love AA, and so I was always going to meetings and working the steps, thank God, because there was a part of me that did get wrapped up in this outside stuff. When I had about 16 years on the program, we broke up, and it was a very sad divorce for me. And I truly had to leave this relationship if I wanted to stay sober. And I can't really get into the details, but trust me, it was one of those issues. I remember someone saying to me once, you're going to come to a point in your life and in your sobriety where you're going to have to make a change between your sobriety and everything else. And it really happened at that time. And I was so grateful to know that I had been giving lip service to this for a long time, but it was true. Somewhere along the line, I really knew that it was true. And so I left this relationship, and I was thrust into instant poverty. and I was sad, really, really sad. And I don't know what you guys do here, but where I come from, they take Beverly Hills and you take the valley. And I went to different meetings, and we were like the AA couple. And, you know, that was part of my identity, too. But I started going to these other meetings, and people would say, are you new? And my ego wanted to give them my AA resume, you know, and as if that meant anything. But I thought, you know what, Kay? It is a day at a time, and you're as new as you were 16 years ago. What you got to do is be a newcomer without getting loaded. And I've had to start over on this program many, many times. And I'll tell you, I think the thing that's helped me more than anything else is the willingness to be teachable again and again and again, and to never assume that time on this program is a tool, because it isn't, you know. And we're sober by the grace of God and the program that we work today. And I would go to these meetings, and I took the coffee ground and cigarette butt commitment, you know, not the secretary commitment, but the down in the trenches kind of work, the mop work, you know, the stuff that I did all the time. And I went to this meeting that no one knew me, and it was great, and I started to get to know people again. And I had this little house in the valley, really teeny little house. And I would have my anxiety attacks came back. You know, I was, that's how it is, you know, sometimes. And I remember calling a friend of mine at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I said, Riley, intellectually I know that when God closes one door, he opens another. But what do you do when you're in the hallway? And he said, you sweep the hallway. And I got off the phone, and I took him literally at first, you know, program of action. I got my broom out and started sweeping my hallway. And then I realized that he meant it figuratively as well, and that is that life is not really, at least for me, a series of one door shutting and another one opening. There's a lot of time in the hallway. And there's a lot of times when it's painful and your heart is broken in two. And it's just how it is. And, you know, you just put one little foot in front of the other. And I remember talking to my sponsor, and I said, Julie, am I ever, remember those feelings when you've had those moments where you talk to your sponsor and you say, are you ever going to be happy again? Am I ever going to not feel this pain again? And she said, not only are you going to not feel this pain, you will be reciting this story in no time, and you're going to have difficulty even remembering the pain that you're feeling right now. And I thought, no, that's impossible. But it's true, because in spite of us, we heal. The program enables us to stay put, stay focused, and do what we're supposed to do, and time takes care of the rest. And it saves our life every single day. After that, a couple years later, I had wanted to be in a relationship again eventually, you know. I mean, I think it's sort of, it's not mandatory, but it's sort of human nature, I think, to want to pair up now and then. So I had invested the help of a tarot card reader. Now, I had never done that before because I really didn't believe in that sort of thing, but this friend turned me on to her. So anyway, this woman came over and she had all the tarot cards spread out. It was one Saturday morning and we're looking at the Queen of Cups and the this and the that. And I said, "So what do you think? Am I gonna be with anybody again?" And she looked and she said, "No." I said, "No?" She said, "No, I don't see it." And I said, "Oh my God." So I said, "You know what you do is you hire another tarot card reader is what you do." And I did. And she saw the same thing. It was like nothing in the cards. And I thought, God bless. Well, anyway, so I thought, well, okay, fine. You know, the program doesn't promise us this, and this. It promises us to be sober and to live a spiritual way of life and to go about our Father's business, which is what we do, which is what we do. And about 2 years later, I had joined a gay sober bowling league with my friend Eileen, basically just for exercise. And it was the big closing tournament. And it was, and I was the captain of the team, but I was not the best bowler on the team by any means. But this lovely person was, and she bowled a strike, and we won the tournament, and that was it. Love at first strike. So anyway, we've been together ever since. And she wanted to come to this weekend, but she had to work. But anyway, and she's got 9 years of sobriety, and she's great. And my whole life is, everybody I know and am close to is an Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my favorite people, and you guys are in for a treat, is your speaker on Saturday night, Patty O. If you've never heard her, she is the best. She's one of my dearest, dearest friends. I don't want to put pressure on her. She's not here, so she won't get nervous about this, but she is terrific. But everybody in my life that I surround myself with are sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they care as passionately about AA as I do. We just love it. And I had also wanted a career. You know, again, it's sort of human nature to want a career. And I had been in the corporate travel industry, and I had worked for this company for 18 years. I was a vendor of this particular company. And about 2 years ago, the CEO, who I was very close to, called me and said, "I want you to come work for us." And I was so flattered and so honored. And I went to work for her, and like I said, she just this last week resigned and was sort of forced to. And basically, the talk is that people that were perceived as part of her extended group are may not have jobs, you know. And so I don't know. You know, I really don't know. And I remember this week I had gone to interview with the Dodgers, as I told you. And I don't think I got it. And anyway, so, and I realized that what I was doing, because I was talking to God during my bubble bath this week, and I was talking to God, and I said, "Oh, God, please, I know how to get out of this. I'll go work for the Dodgers. That'll save me from having to deal with this." And I realized, sitting in the bathtub, that perhaps that's not what God wants for me. That maybe God wants for me to go through this, whatever this is. And sometimes I think I have the right answer. Because to me, it's simple. Put me with the Dodgers. That's all you have to do. It's easy. Then I can quit and it'll be on my own terms. And I can save face and everything else. I want it on my own terms. And that's just sort of not how it is sometimes, you know. And what AA has done for me is it's given me the courage. And I'm not a courageous person. I never have been. I'm not courageous now. With AA, though, with the tools of this program, I take actions that make me look like I'm courageous. And to the outside world, that's all they see. I was, during that 16-year divorce thing, when I was my anxiety attacks had come back, and believe me, I fly a lot, but during that period of time, my anxiety attacks came back. And I was, you never want one on an airplane, I'll tell you, as you know. It's not that you're afraid the plane's going to crash. With me, it's that I'm afraid I'm going to have an anxiety attack, flip out, and make a fool of myself in front of my fellow flight mates, you know. But anyway, sure enough, I'm flying from New York to Los Angeles, and I start to have one. And I'm thinking, damn, you know, it's been 16. I mean, really, it had been about 16 years since I had one. But I remembered, and I knew what they felt like, and sure enough, it started. And it was just this fear started entering in again. I thought, oh, no, please, no. I started getting scared, but I did what I did all the time. What I do now. He talks about in step 11 that when our channel to God is perhaps choked up with fear, that we might recite a prayer or a phrase over and over again until we can, you know, be at one with our higher power. And so I have this sort of chant that I do when shit really hits the fan, because I need something that rhymes and is quick. And instead of the serenity prayer, what I was at the moment to ward off this anxiety attack, I started reciting this prayer that my mother actually taught me, which is, God is guiding me, guarding me, directing me, and protecting me. Guiding, guarding, directing, and protecting. And I just started saying it over and over again privately, you know, to myself. And then I got out my 12 and 12 and started reading and just, again, just thought, just get through this, just get through this. And it lasted about an hour and a half. And the reason I know that is we were over Kansas City, and the pilot came on to say, we're over Kansas City. And finally, I started to relax. I thought, oh, God, you know, and I started the sweating, and I got up, and I was fine, and I said, thank you, God. And I got up, and I went into the restroom, freshened up a tad, and then I came out, and one of my clients at the time was on the plane in the same section as me, and he said, oh, I didn't know you were on the airplane with me. And I said, yeah. And he said, want to join me for a drink? And I said, I don't drink, but... And he said, you dumb. He said, oh, my God. He said, look at you. You're calm as a cucumber. I could never be a flyer like you. He said, boy, I envy you. And I thought, you know, sometimes they just don't know how much it takes for us to be on planet Earth. You know what I'm saying? For me, life is not easy for me. I used to think that if I worked a good enough program and long enough and this many years, that eventually I would cross the invisible line into normalcy. And actually now I realize, you know, what is normal? You know, I've since seen a lot of people, and I don't know how normal they are, you know what I mean? I think we're normal. What I mean by that is we're doing an abnormal thing by being sober due to Alcoholics Anonymous in our lives. But I think we're normal. I think we're human, and that's what we get here to be, is we get to be human. And I'm no longer ashamed that I'm sort of quirky. I'm no longer ashamed that I'm sort of frightened. My boss at work called me in, and he gave me my review recently, my other boss. And he said, you're doing a great job. He said, the only thing I would say about you, he said, you're a little paranoid. And I said, yeah, that's something I have to work on. I said, yeah, it's just sort of my nature. And I believe that it is. And I believe that my nature now is pretty much the nature of that little girl on the white chair. But my tools are different, and I can be an adult in the world today, and I have a wonderful life today. It isn't perfect. I don't know what's going to happen when I get back to L.A. I don't know if I have a job waiting for me. Don't know. What I do know is that when I look back on my 24 and a half years in Alcoholics Anonymous, God has never left me alone. Not once. Never. Through anxiety attacks and meetings, through broken hearts, through disappointments, I have never been left alone on this program. We're everywhere. We have all we need in life with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe we are the luckiest people on the face of the earth. I want to thank the committee for asking me to speak tonight. This has been a true an honor to be with you and share with you. I was so happy when I found out I was first, because I knew I would basically be done and be able to enjoy the rest of the week. And I want to share one last story, though. When I was new, I used to, if I was bored in a meeting, let's say, I would fantasize that one day I would be like a circuit speaker. Now, I never became a circuit speaker, which is fine. This was a childhood sort of fantasy, right? And I was new, and I'd think, oh, boy. But my fantasy was big. My fantasy was that I would have this private jet. And I had it all worked out, you know? And I remember, as clear as it was yesterday, I was just maybe 3 months of sobriety, and I just think, oh, one day, you know, I'm going to be at the main speaker. And the fantasy was that my private jet would land, I'd get off, I'd be this big executive, and I'd have, like, my coat, not even wearing it, just sort of over the shoulder. And I'd have my luggage, you know, And I'd be getting there as fast as I could because I was just so, so awfully important. And I get to this big convention, and there's this long hallway between the seats, and I'm running up to the podium. And say, oh, thank God she made it, and it's just like 1 minute to go. And I'm running up, and as I'm running up to the podium to be the marvelous whatever, I hear someone in the audience saying, you know what, she has all that, and she's humble, too. And the thing is, what I missed about that whole fantasy that I'm able to see now with different eyes, of course, is that my fantasy was, oh, how important I will one day be, not how humble I will be. And the greatest gift that I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous is humility. I used to think that step 7 was just, they just put it in there because they had to put something between those, you know, 6 and 8. And I used to bypass it for years. I would skip it. And I'd skip it. And in the last few years, it is my favorite step in Alcoholics Anonymous, that God does for me what I cannot do for myself, and is by the grace of God that any good in my life whatsoever comes from God. And I know that now. And what a freedom that is. Again, thank you, and let's have a great weekend. Thanks for having us today.